Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be here.
Today we're jumping into one of the most fascinating and honestly complex relationships in the Middle East. The intricate story of the Kurdish and Jewish peoples, specifically looking at the period before 2010.
Right. And this isn't, you know, a straightforward history lesson.
No, not at all. It's really a centuries-long narrative. We're talking coexistence, major transformations, even unexpected alliances, all shaped by geography and, well, some pretty turbulent political shifts.
Absolutely. We'll be looking at how this relationship moved from, say, intimate daily life in the Kurdic Highlands to something quite different, a strategic, often covert alliance between Israel and a stateless Kurdish movement.
And that story isn't always easy to piece together, is it?
No, definitely not. Written records, especially for the earlier periods, are quite scarce. So we rely heavily on oral traditions, ethnographic work, personal memoirs, much of which was only systematically recorded in the last century or so.
So we'll trace this through roughly four eras. We'll start with the ancient roots, medieval life, then move into the Ottoman and Persian periods. After that, the big upheaval nationalism, the Jewish exodus, and finally, this new geopolitical reality, the secret alliance, and the role of diaspora memory.
That covers it.
When you think about this whole sweep of history, what's the first thing that really stands out?
For me, it's the sheer depth and persistence of the connection, often below the surface of official history, how intertwined their fates were, even when formal records don't show it. Those oral histories are just crucial. It really speaks to resilience, I think.
Okay, let's unpack this journey then. Starting right at the beginning, the ancient foundations, medieval coexistence. Say, antiquity up to around 1500 CE. And you might be surprised just how far back this goes.
It's fascinating, yeah. The connection is really deeply rooted. You've got this powerful mix of historical accounts, biblical geography, and, importantly, foundational myths.
Myths. Tell me more.
Well, for Kurdistani Jews themselves, there's a strong, persistent oral tradition that they're descendants of the 10 lost tribes of Israel.
The ones exiled by the Assyrians back in the 8th century BCE.
Exactly. And what's interesting is the biblical account in 2 Kings, it actually mentions locations for their settlement. Hala, Habor, the Gozan River, cities of the Medes, which geographically overlap with Kurdistan.
So this wasn't just a story they told. It was fundamental to their identity.
Completely. They even called themselves Anshe Targum, people of the language of the Targum.
Connecting themselves to Aramaic, the language of the Talmudic era.
Right. They saw themselves as possibly the oldest Jewish exile community in the world. It's a powerful self-perception.
And are there more concrete historical links beyond that?
Oh, yes. We have, for instance, the royal house of Eriyebeni, right there in Erbil, converting to Judaism in the 1st century CE.
The whole royal family.
Queen Helena, her son, King Monobaz, they're actually praised in the Talmud for their piety, their support for the temple in Jerusalem.
Wow.
And then you have linguistic clues in early texts. Onkelos translating mountains of Ararat as mountains of Kardu. Josephus mentions the mountains of Kudikim. The Talmud even notes that one accepts proselytes from the Kardus. It suggests long-term interaction.
So it's like the story's literally woven into the land itself. I remember reading about tombs of prophets like Nahum and Alquash, Daniel and Kirkuk.
Exactly. Major pilgrimage sites for Jews located right there in Kurdistan.
Mm-hmm.
It really embedded their religious life in the region.
Okay, so fast forward to the medieval period. What did the community look like then?
It was substantial. Benjamin of Tudela, the 12th century traveler, he documented over 100 Jewish settlements.
100?
Yeah. Including, remarkably, he claimed 25,000 Jews in Ahmadiyya alone. Probably an exaggeration, but it indicates a significant presence. They had scholars, they spoke Aramaic. Communities in places like Mosul were known to be well-organized, fairly wealthy, enjoying a degree of autonomy.
And the mountains weren't just home, they were also a refuge, right?
A vital sanctuary, yes. Especially during things like the Crusades. You see Jews fleeing persecution in Syria, Palestine, finding relative safety in Kurdistan and Babylonia.
But not totally cut off. I remember reading about David Arroy.
Right, the 12th century messianic figure from Ahmadiyya, aiming to lead people back to Jerusalem, even planning to conquer it. It shows that the region wasn't just a passive refuge, it was also a place for spiritual, even political movements connected to Zion.
So the takeaway from this early period is that the Jewish presence was deep, foundational, tied to identity, landscape, sacred sites.
Precisely. It set the stage for everything that followed.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbosh Hannah. Ah, perfect timing. You know, every time Hannah brings the chai, it's a moment to pause. Let's see how this batches today. Lovely and strong, but I think it could use just a touch more sugar to really bring out the sweetness. What do you think?
You know, I think you're right. Just a bit more sweetness would balance it perfectly. It's got that wonderful warmth, though, definitely what we need before diving into the next part of the story.
Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. That chai hit the spot. Now, picking up where we left off, let's talk about life under the big empires, Ottoman and Persian, roughly 1501 to 1918. This era introduces this really complex system, often called feudal patronage.
Right. And if we think about the bigger picture, Jews in the Kurdish highlands were dealing with sort of a dual authority.
How so?
Well, at the empire level, especially the Ottoman Empire, they were part of the Jewish millet that granted them legal autonomy, you know, internal affairs managed under a chief rabbi, the Hakambashi.
Okay, so some official recognition.
Yes, but the day-to-day reality, that was often governed much more by these semi-autonomous Kurdish emirates or powerful local tribal chiefs, the Akas.
So your actual safety, your daily life, depended more on the local Aga than some official in Istanbul or Tehran?
Pretty much. And this balance, which was always delicate, got seriously disrupted in the 19th century.
The Ottoman Tanzimat reform.
Exactly. These were attempts to centralize power, modernize the state. But one major consequence was the dismantling of those autonomous Kurdish emirates, like Bedirin Khans around the 1840s.
So taking away that layer of local governance, what did that mean for minorities like the Jews?
It meant they were left dealing directly with either a weaker central state or, more often, these now unchecked tribal leaders, some of whom even formed the Hamidi cavalry, which was state-sponsored and, frankly, brutal towards minorities, especially Armenians later on. This really shifted the power dynamics locally.
It sounds like it created a much more precarious situation. How did Jewish communities navigate that, especially without their own tribal backup?
Well, this gets us to the heart of it, the Aga and the Jew. In these often pretty lawless areas, security was the main currency. So Jewish families, lacking that tribal structure, essentially put themselves under an Aga's protection.
And in return?
In return, they paid dues, gave gifts, provided labor, various services. It was very much a transactional relationship.
A transaction based on protection. But it sounds like a double-edged sword.
Completely. A paradox, really. Security on one hand, but servitude on the other. It depended entirely on the individual Aga.
Mordecai Zakin's research, based on oral histories, really highlights this, doesn't it?
It paints a vivid picture, yeah. You hear stories of terrible exploitation. He even uses the term slavery of rural Jews who could literally be sold or given away.
Mm-hmm.
Constant demands for money, the threat of daughters being abducted for forced conversion.
Needing permission just to move village.
Yes, that level of control. But then you also hear many accounts of Agas who were genuinely protective, benevolent, saved and protected the Jews unconditionally, as some testimonies put it.
Like the Jews of Zaka remembering their chief's protection even as they left for Israel in 51.
Exactly. So it's not a contradiction that cancels out. It shows the reality. Security came at the price of being dependent, often subservient. Simultaneously protected and captive is how Zakin describes it.
Yet, despite this really difficult system, they maintained a distinct identity.
Very much so. They identified as Kurdistani Jews, or Jews of Kurdistan, emphasizing their Mizrahi Jewish identity, separate from ethnic Kurds. They lived in distinct Jewish quarters, spoke their own language, Judeo-Aramaic.
Lishna Yahudia.
Right. A direct link to their ancient past. Now, of course, there was cultural borrowing, clothing, music, some Kurdish vocabulary. You couldn't live side by side for centuries without that.
But it wasn't assimilation.
No. It was adaptation. Cultural permeability, alongside maintaining ethnic and religious separation. That strategy allowed for coexistence without losing who they were.
And they maintained a vibrant religious and intellectual life, too.
Absolutely. Think of Esenath Barzani in the 17th century, a renowned scholar of Torah, Talmud, Kabbalah, heading a yeshiva. Quite remarkable for that time and place. Shows the intellectual life wasn't extinguished by the tough conditions.
Economically, what roles did they play?
A really diverse and vital niche. They were merchants, traders, skilled artisans, weavers, dyers, carpenters, jewelers. Some were even raftsmen on the rivers.
And uniquely farmers too, right? Which wasn't common elsewhere.
That's a key point. Many rural Jews were farmers, shepherds, even landowners, growing crops, owning vineyards. That's quite different from many other parts of the Muslim world where land ownership by non-Muslims was often restricted. So that local autonomy, while risky, did offer some unique economic paths.
Then culturally, Any specific traditions stand out?
The Severine Festival is a great example, an annual post-Passover celebration out in nature, music, dancing, storytelling, and their music itself was this incredible blend.
A mix of influences.
Four main ones: Hebrew for prayer, Aramaic for study, Arabic for urban songs, and then the local Kurdish Gurmanji style for folk epics and dances. It perfectly mirrors their identity rooted in Jewish tradition, but deeply connected to their Kurdish environment.
So we've seen these centuries of, well, complex coexistence, but now we hit the early 20th century, 1918 to 1952 or so, and things really start to fall apart. You call this the Great Unraveling.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, because the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the rise of these new modern nation states, it just shattered that old framework.
How did these new nationalisms affect Kurdistani Jews specifically?
Well, you had aggressive, centralizing nationalisms taking hold, particularly Arab nationalism in Iraq and Turkish nationalism in Turkey. For Jews in Iraqi Kurdistan, the new kingdom of Iraq meant Baghdad called the shots. That old localized Aga system was replaced by direct rule from an Arab nationalist capital.
And that wasn't necessarily good news. The 1941 Farhud pogrom in Baghdad.
That was a terrifying turning point. A brutal anti-Jewish riot. It showed that Jewish security was no longer guaranteed, even in the capital. Now, remote Kurdish areas were maybe a bit insulated at first.
But then Israel was created in 1948.
And that changed everything. Anti-Zionist hostility, actively promoted by the Iraqi state, started to seep into Kurdistan. It poisoned those day-to-day relationships that had often been positive. There's that chilling quote from an interviewee.
Dir Yassin.
Yeah. When they heard that in Dir Yassin, the Jews slaughtered Arabs, then the hatred started. It shows how distant events, amplified by state propaganda, could dramatically shift local feelings.
And what about in Turkey?
A different flavor of nationalism, but similar negative consequences. Atatürk's secular republic pushed hard for Turkification, suppressing non-Turkish cultures. You had events like the 1934 anti-Jewish pogroms in Thrace, and the Varlık Vergisi, that punitive wealth tax in 1942 that hit non-Muslims disproportionately hard. It created this climate of insecurity that just pushed people to leave.
So the mass emigration to Israel, the Aliyah, it wasn't just one single cause.
No, not at all. It's best understood as this powerful combination of push and pull factors.
The push being
escalating state-sponsored anti-Semitism, especially from Baghdad after 48, stripping citizenship, freezing assets, creating an environment of suspicion, sometimes violence and theft, just making life untenable.
And the pull.
This was incredibly strong, particularly in those more isolated traditional rural communities. It was a deeply religious, almost messianic Zionism.
Not political Zionism, but religious fulfillment.
Exactly. For centuries, their prayers ended next year in Jerusalem, the creation of Israel. For them, that was the literal fulfillment of biblical prophecy. Immigration wasn't just escaping danger. It was seen as a sacred duty.
There's that quote, "When we were going to Jerusalem, to the gates of paradise, we came full of joy."
Right. For many, that religious pull was arguably even stronger than the push of anti-Semitism.
And this culminated in Operations Ezra and Nehemiah, the big airlift in 1950-51.
Yes. An agreement was struck between Israel and Iraq. Iraq let its Jews leave, but only if they renounced citizenship and left everything behind. Almost the entire community left. We're talking 20,000, maybe 30,000 Jews from Kurdistan alone.
From around 200 settlements, an entire ancient community gone in a year or two.
It's staggering. Nearly 2,000 from Zako alone.
The personal stories from that time must be harrowing.
They are. People flown out on planes with no seats, just sitting on the floor, families selling homes, then having the money frozen by the government, arriving in Israel completely destitute, living in tents for years. Incredible hardship, mixed with that sense of religious fulfillment.
But here's a really poignant detail you mentioned. Despite the official hostility from Baghdad, many local Kurdish neighbors were apparently sad to see them go.
Yes, that's a crucial distinction. There are accounts of Kurds mourning the loss of their Jewish friends, even maintaining empty synagogues for years out of respect.
What does that tell us?
It shows this stark disconnect, doesn't it, between the abstract ideological hatred pushed by the central state and the actual long-standing personal relationships on the ground in Kurdistan. The end of that shared communal life wasn't really an internal collapse. It was imposed from the outside by these big political forces.
So the physical community is gone from Kurdistan, but the story doesn't end there. The relationship transforms again from 1952 up to around 2010. It shifts from neighbors to something else.
Something very different. A clandestine geopolitical alliance.
How did that come about?
Well, Israel, after its creation, found itself surrounded by hostile Arab states. So under Ben-Gurion, they developed what became known as the Periphery Doctrine.
The idea being to build alliances with non-Arab states or groups on the edges of the Middle East?
Exactly. Like Turkey, pre-revolutionary Iran, Ethiopia. And the Kurds fit perfectly into this.
A large non-Arab group fighting against Iraq, one of Israel's main adversaries.
Precisely. And the groundwork had actually been laid much earlier. Reuven Shiloah, who later headed the Mossad, visited Kurdistan way back in 1931, making contacts.
And after the Aliyah, those Kurdistani Jewish immigrants in Israel became a key resource.
A vital resource. They provided the intelligence, the language skills, the cultural understanding that formed the basis of Israel's policy towards the Kurds. This evolved into a secret but very substantial alliance, mainly between Israel and Mullah Mustafa Barzani's KDP. It really peaked between 68 and 75.
And this wasn't just talk, right? Israel provided real support.
Oh, extensive covert support. Military training, codenamed Operation Marvad. Advanced weapons, including Soviet arms captured in the 67 war. Intelligence sharing. Significant funding, too, reportedly $50,000 a month after 67. Israeli officers were actually on the ground in Kurdistan.
That's a serious partnership. Barzani himself visited Israel.
At least twice, secretly, in 68 and 73. Met with Prime Minister Eshkol, other top leaders. His sons Masoud and Idris visited, too. It was high-level stuff.
So what was the strategic payoff for each side?
For the Kurds, Israeli help was absolutely critical. It arguably allowed their movement to survive against the Iraqi army and gave them a valuable link to the West. For Israel, the Kurdish rebellion tied down huge portions of the Iraqi military.
Meaning Iraq couldn't fully commit its army against Israel in the 67 or 73 wars.
Exactly. Plus, invaluable intelligence flowed back to Israel. It was a classic enemy of my enemy situation that served both their interests well.
Until 1975. The Algiers Agreement.
A bitter end. The Shah of Iran suddenly cut a deal with Saddam Hussein and ended all support for the Kurds. Since Iran was the main channel for Israeli aid, that pulled the rug out completely, seen as a massive betrayal by both the Kurds and many Israelis.
Was this alliance universally popular among the Kurds themselves?
No, and that's important.
Yeah.
It really highlighted a major split between the two main Iraqi Kurdish parties. The KDP, the Barzanis, saw it pragmatically as a strategic necessity. Masoud Barzani later said, you know, relations between Kurds and Israel is not a crime.
But the PUK, Jalal Talabani's party, felt differently.
Very differently. Talabani historically opposed it, calling it a significant mistake. The PUK had different ideological leanings, more leftist, some pan-Arabist sympathies early on, closer ties to Iran and Syria, countries where opposing Israel is fundamental. It reflects a deep, ongoing debate in Kurdish politics about foreign alliances.
Okay, but beyond the politics, what about the people? The Kurdistani Jewish community in Israel, they didn't just disappear into the background.
Far from it. They grew to around 200,000 people and became this incredibly powerful living link.
More than just refugees.
Much more. They became an active political and cultural force. As we said, they were Israel's primary source for intel and understanding of Kurdistan. But beyond that, they became passionate advocates for the Kurdish cause within Israel. Excellent ambassadors, they've been called.
Especially after the 1991 Gulf War and the Kurdish uprising.
Yes. The community mobilized huge relief efforts, held demonstrations, lobbied the Israeli government, lobbied the U.S., pushing for intervention and protection for the Kurds. Their collective memory became a real soft power asset, influencing Israeli public opinion and policy.
And they kept their own culture alive, too.
Diligently. The Aramaic language, their unique music, food, festivals like the Sarayin. They kept the memory of Kurdistan alive for generations born in Israel.
This connection led to that term, Second Israel.
Yeah, a really loaded term. Used as a slur by Arab nationalists to try and delegitimize the Kurds, painting them as another Zionist project. But for many Kurds and Israelis, it became almost a badge of honor, symbolizing this shared experience of being persecuted, minorities fighting for self-determination.
So looking back at this whole arc before 2010, it's quite a journey, starting way back in antiquity with shared myths, a shared landscape.
Deep roots in the mountains of Kurdistan, then evolving over centuries into that complex coexistence under the Aga system, that strange mix of protection and captivity.
A very personal, localized world that was then completely overturned by 20th century nationalism.
Right. The hostile policies from Baghdad and Ankara combined with that powerful religious pull of Zionism leading to the exodus in the early 50s, ending a presence that was, what, 2,700 years old?
But not ending the relationship?
No, transforming it. Reborn in the Cold War context is the secret alliance between Israel and the KDP, driven by Israel's periphery doctrine and the Kurds' desperate need for allies, the enemy of my enemy.
So by 2010, the whole dynamic is unrecognizable compared to, say, 1910. It's no longer about neighbors sharing a village.
No. It's about two distinct political entities, a sovereign state and a stateless nation striving for statehood, bound together not by daily life, but by this intricate web of shared memory, overlapping strategic interests, and crucially, that Kurdistani Jewish diaspora in Israel acting as the living bridge.
It leaves us with quite a paradox, doesn't it?
It really does. The very forces nationalism, the desire for self-determination that created a kind of kinship between these two peoples, were the exact same forces that physically ripped them apart and set them on these parallel yet still connected paths.
What implications might this whole story hold for other stateless peoples or other diaspora communities trying to navigate today's complex world? That's definitely something to think about.
Indeed.
Thank you for joining us for this exploration on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. We hope it's given you some new perspectives on this incredibly compelling history. Until next time.